Well, the final moments of a recent playoff hockey game in Russia. SKA St. Petersburg were taking on the Severstal Sharapovits. It was the quarterfinals, and they were battling it out for the Gagarin Cup. It is the ultimate prize in Russia's elite professional hockey league, the KHL. And this game was something of a David and Goliath matchup, the defending champs facing a feisty underdog. It was a game that ended in controversy. Controversy, a very telling controversy, according to our first guest, who says that playoff game can tell us a lot about the state of Vladimir Putin's Russia today. Slava Malamud was born and raised in the Soviet Union. For 15 years, he was a foreign correspondent for Russia's largest sports magazine. He now writes about the KHL for the Journal de Montréal, and we have reached him today in Baltimore. Hello.
Hello.
Well, first of all, tell me a little bit about the teams involved in this series.
Well, SKA St. Petersburg is a team with a long history, but it's a team with a long history of failure. They used to be basically the Soviet Army's scrap heap. They would receive players who were not good enough to play for CSKA, the major Soviet team from Moscow. But a few years from now, about 10 years from now, they began accumulating a lot of money, a lot of sponsors, specifically Gazprom, Russia's number one, the world's number one natural gas exporter, which is owned by the state, and it's owned by Putin's friends, and who also happen to be the major movers and shakers in the KHL. It's become basically the flagship team of Russia. It's very difficult to tell the leadership of SKA from the leadership of the KHL and from the leadership of Russia as a whole, because it's all run by people very, very close to Vladimir Putin. It's also provided most of the players to the national team that won the gold in Pyeongchang.
So this is the pride and joy of Russian hockey, so to speak.
Yeah, they basically become what Red Army Moscow used to be in the Soviet Union.
Okay, and what about its opponents? The Sharapovits, as the team is known.
Yes, Sharapovits is the city in northern Russia, not a big city at all. It's basically centered around a major steel mill. Severstal is the name of the company that owns them. It means northern steel. Their major achievement back in the pre-KHL, they was making the finals once, and even then it was a huge upset. And the team has been struggling a lot with finances. Northern Steel is a big steel mill, but you know they're not fond of losing millions of dollars, and they don't have any political backing. And this team was basically considered by the KHL for contraction, since the KHL wants to eliminate two or three teams this summer. Precisely because of the bad press that's associated with struggling teams that don't pay their players on time. But Sharapovits has responded by having a great season. I mean, they made the playoffs, which was completely unexpected. Their fans have completely behind the team. They sell out most of their games. It's a small arena, but still. And all of a sudden, with nothing to lose and possibly staring at the abyss of contraction, they've given SKA this incredible battle in the first round of the playoffs. They got swept, but every single game was close, and two of them ended in overtime, and a couple of them were very, very controversial.
Okay, this sounds like epic, great hockey, right? For those of us who follow North American hockey, this is like the underdog takes on the big team, and you know, most people rooting for that underdog. It is a David and Goliath battle when it comes to this matchup in the KHL, and you are especially interested in the way game two of this series went down. So tell us about that game. What happened?
Well, game one was a game in which SKA played a day after the team, most of the team participated in President Putin's pre-election rally, and word is they were a bit hungover and they didn't play very well. And Sharapovits came out of the gate roaring. They were up 2-1 in the third, and then the refs just started putting them away with those penalties. And they wound up with 24 penalty minutes, including a 2-on-10, 2+10, and a really iffy collision near the boards. That result in SKA coming back. Looks like they scored the game-winning goal in that penalty. It was 3-2. And then with a minute left, Sharapovits pulls the goalie and ties it up. So the refs re- respond by giving them two penalties in overtime, and SKA win. The second game was close, but then SKA eventually prevailed thanks to superior offense. But the third game was a real peach, because SKA's game-winning goal in overtime was scored after the referees not only missed an obvious case of offside, they also ignored it when they watched the replay, because the play was challenged by the Chirpovets coach, and everybody saw that it was offside.
Yeah, when you say it was obvious, this would be obvious to any human that knew anything about hockey that it was offside.
Well, I mean, especially if you watch the replay, it was a fast sequence, but once you watch the replay, the puck was about a foot offside. It definitely came out of the zone. Pretty impossible to miss. The KHL's explanation that they didn't have that camera angle is kind of ridiculous. But you know, what are they going to say? The KHL leader, the NHL isn't fond of admitting its mistake, and the KHL obviously isn't going to be fond of doing that either.
I want to read you, so that's game three, and I want to read you a quote from the official KHL website's description of that game, which SKA won in overtime. Here's what it said. Not for the first time, SKA finds itself on the brink of a series sweep, not so much by virtue of dominant hockey, but thanks to its ability to conjure a way to win in difficult circumstances. And I want to pick up on that word, conjure a way to win. Is there something that I'm supposed to get there? Is this lost in translation, or is this the writer dropping some hints?
It's hard to say sometimes, but I know that Severstal has really been very sarcastic about the whole thing. They posted a picture of two referees watching the replay with a caption, "I think I can see the Gagarin Cup in there." They posted the video of the goal with the words "game winning goal" in quotations. As for SKA, I mean, yeah, I think here the writer was just being a little bit flowery and trying to show that the team has a flair for dramatics.
Okay, all right. That's fair. That's what good writers do, right? I want to play a bit of tape for you. We spoke to a Canadian hockey player, Ryan Garbutt. He's played for Sochi and more recently for Slovan in the KHL, which is based in Slovakia. And we asked him about officiating in the KHL. Listen to this.
I think that in general that the Russian refs don't... I don't really want to say too much, depending on if I'm going back to the league or not. But I think that I've heard stories from other players that talk about the bias of the refs. I've seen it a little bit myself. But I think that when you're one of the European teams playing against a Russian team, you know it's going to be an uphill battle that night. And I think that kind of emulates through the rest of the league.
Slava Malamud, what do you hear in that comment from Ryan Garbutt?
I think Ryan said a mouthful without saying too much. I hope he doesn't jeopardize his future sightings. But you know, it's really not anything secret in Russia. It's basically common knowledge. And I don't know any instances myself, and I don't really think that the referees get an order sent to them or by email from the league offices that, you know, you have to call certain plays a certain way. But referees are human beings. And when you're refereeing a game where one of the team, you know that it's supported by every single person who signs your paycheck. You know that very important people are watching from the stands. You know that the team is full of anyone who is anyone in the KHL as far as star power goes. And especially in the Olympic year, when getting one of these people hurt before the Olympics is going to have major political repercussions, how are you going to call that game?
Slava Malamud, you make the case that, you know, in the end, SKA swept the series. And you have suggested that the way that it turned out is a metaphor for life beyond hockey in Russia under Vladimir Putin. So explain that to me.
Putin has eliminated very methodically, throughout his reign, all the vestiges of a free democratic society from Russia. He began by taking over most major media outlets. Then he moved down to major companies where they were basically confiscated from the oligarchs, no doubt corrupt ones, but still not connected to Putin, and then passed to very corrupt oligarchs who are connected to Putin. And to he then went on after the elections. He eliminated first the direct elections of governors, then basically he eliminated all of the political opposition. And very methodically, very slowly, over the course of 18 years, he set himself up as basically as the czar of Russian and anything but name. His cronies own the league, and the fact that it's his election year and he's actively using players in his electoral campaigns, I mean, you don't really have to be a genius to connect the dots, right?
Slava Malamud, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Slava Malamud writes about the KHL for the Journal de Montréal. He was in Baltimore today. We also reached out to the KHL and to the Russian embassy for comment on our story, but we have had no reply. Well, our next guest says that Slava Malamud's account of hockey treachery points to a dark current of cynicism in Russian culture. Michael Idov learned about that firsthand as editor-in-chief of GQ Russia. He was a tabloid celebrity hanging out with members of Pussy Riot, acting alongside rapper Snoop Dogg and writing Russia's top-grossing domestic movie of 2015. He is also the author of the newly released memoir, Dressed Up for a Riot. Michael Idov is in Berlin. Hello.
Hi, Pia. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. First off, tell me, how does Slava Malamud's criticism of the KHL resonate with your understanding of Russia?
Well, it's interesting. Slava said this really kind of an offhand thing. Well, everything in Russia is rigged. And while I don't disagree with that, the thing that makes the Russian kind of oppression and authoritarianism kind of trickier than, you know, the notion that we instantly have in our heads of just like a full-on, you know, oppression, is that the reason everything is rigged is everyone thinks it's rigged. It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I've seen a lot of that when I was living in Russia, and my book is partly about that.
So help me understand that a little bit more, because if the fix is in everything, Michael Idov, whether it is with sport, which doesn't seem like it's very fun to watch when you know the fix is in, why, and that Russians know what's going on in hockey and beyond, that the fix isn't, why do they accept it?
Well, you know, an election is also not a lot of fun to participate in when the fix is in.
Fair.
And, as we're going to see very soon, I think, you know, in what is it, exactly 7 days from now, Putin, of course, is going to win at the upcoming Russian election. The only question is, are people going to show up? And that's why the only thing that the Russians are actually really worried about, the Putin government is really worried about, is getting people out to the polls because of this overbearing anarchy, you know, this kind of apathy that the Russians have been feeling about the political process. Now, why are they okay with it? Well, it's simple. I mean, we have to admit that at the same time as the Russians have been completely politically disenfranchised, they're also living, even in present conditions, even with the ruble down and the sanctions against them, they're still living better than they had in the 90s and in the last couple of decades of the Soviet Union, which a lot of, you know, Putin's base still remember quite vividly. And the Putin's propaganda has always been about, not about talking about how great Putin is, you know, although that in time became a part of it, but also about how Putin is basically the only thing that stands between stability and, you know, either just complete, you know, criminal chaos of the 90s or, you know, fascism, which is how they're repositioning what's happened in Ukraine and in other places. So yeah, that's basically the daily compromise that a lot of Russians make with themselves, is, you know, placing stability over what they are being increasingly often told is complete chaos that's going to follow Putin, no matter who else will replace him.
Okay, if it's Putin at any cost, in other words, if they know that the fix is in from politics down to hockey, I want to talk to you about a couple other cultural things, but I first want to ask you about this. I read your tweets in response to Slava Malamud. So I want you to talk to me about the role of apathy and fatalism in Russian culture.
That's actually exactly what Slava's tweet storm made me think about, is that there's no underdog narrative in the Russian culture at all. There's no, you know, kids grow up without stories of a scrappy little, you know, little guy, taking on sort of the machine and winning. And what's fascinating is that over the last 5 years or so, there's been a huge rise in Russian sports movies made, basically in 2012, somebody realized that they could take, you know, the movie Miracle about, you know, the U.S. team winning over the Russians in Lake Placid, and they could just kind of flip it on its head and create a movie about the glory of the Russian team winning over the Americans. So they or in that case, actually, the Canadians. It was a huge hit, and then this year, the biggest ever hit in Russian movies. This is this new movie that came out about a month ago called, I believe, Upward Movement, or, you know, or Going Vertical, I think is the official translation. And these are, in fact, kind of underdog narratives, except the underdog is Russia itself. You know, Russia always sees itself as a collective underdog when faced with the West that the Russians are taught to think is against them, and also just kind of have the entire world has conspired against Russia. So they can take, and they love an underdog narrative when it covers a collective standing in for Russia itself. But there is really no culture of an underdog narrative or individualist narrative when it comes to one person standing up against the system. There's a bunch of movies like that, and great movies like Leviathan, that was nominated for the Oscar a couple of years ago, but they always end in the individual failing.
Okay, I want to get you to help us understand a little more about the sort of culture that's pop culture and beyond that about Russian culture. And so, forgive my Russian, I'm going to get you to explain the meaning of a couple of words. So there's a word that I think is nestidny, which I think it means unshameful. Why is that key to Putin's popularity?
That's a funny word, because нестыдный, and you, by the way, did a pretty good job of pronouncing
Thank
it.
Thank you. Спасибо большое, yeah.
All right, it's the Russian accent day at your show today. Well, it literally does mean unshameful, and in certain Russian circles, it has become the term of highest praise you can bestow upon a domestic cultural product, be it a movie, a song, a book. And I've always been fascinated by that, because it implies that the baseline condition of Russian life is this feeling of acute shame of your own culture. And of course, unlike Russia's so-called high culture, which is, you know, ballet, classical literature, etc., the Russian pop culture has always suffered from this inferiority complex when put next to Western pop culture. So it's precisely the westernized, the educated Russians that feel the most ashamed. And by the way, you know, I don't think they should. I think the Russian pop culture is fine, but they feel really, really kind of embarrassed of their own pop culture. So when something comes along that earns their praise, they tend to call it нестыдный, unshameful, something that finally can alleviate this kind of baseline condition of shame for, you know, for a brief moment before we return to our regularly scheduled, you know, feeling of embarrassment.
Okay, here's another Russian word that I want you to put in context for us as we try to understand Russian culture, but also the KHL playing into this. And this is the word ponyatiya, which I understand translate as things that are understood or unwritten rules. So what does it mean to live by ponyatiya?
Right, it's понятие.
Yeah, very
actually.
Good.
And this is a really fascinating term, because it comes from the prison culture, and one of the keys to understanding the Russian mind circa now is actually to realize how much Stalin era purges, which put a sizable chunk of the country's most educated population through the prison system, how much that still affects the Russian consciousness, how much the prison culture and prison prison rules still affect the society. And in fact, понятие is not only part of the prison rules, it in fact sort of means prison rules. It's the unsaid things that you live by as opposed to the real laws written on paper that you actually are free to disregard. And I think that going back to what Slava has been talking about, a lot of this sort of dishonest refereeing that's going on, this is precisely Panyatia. No one has come to these people and said, okay, you have to deliver so and so many points, you know, to Putin's favorite team. We expect you to do this and that. You know, that doesn't happen. Just like the censorship in the Russian arts and letters doesn't really happen in a way that, like, people would get documents sort of handed to them from somewhere above saying, okay, you can't do this, this, and this. What happens is that people try to divine kind of the will of the authorities using these panyatia, using this kind of like almost like trying to catch these sort of waves in the air of like, okay, what's allowed? What is expected of us?
Slava Malamud also suggested that a lot of Vladimir Putin's interest in hockey is connected to his appeals to nostalgia for the Soviet past when Russia had great power, stature, respect. How strong is that idea in Russian culture?
It's prevailing, actually, and it's very sad because the Russians have been taught to think of the 90s, the first decade of relative freedom in their lives, as the time of great humiliation, their humiliation at the hands of the West, because they felt that they weren't consulted enough, they weren't treated as a world superpower. And Putin has been able to build his entire career, his entire reign, on the exploitation of this particular complex. And in reality, I would argue that, you know, Putin doesn't really care about Russia's greatness one way or the other. I mean, it's just become a very convenient hedge for him and his system to basically make sure that they keep their hold on power by exploiting that more and more and more. And, Russia as a besieged fortress narrative. The problem with that is just it needs more and more proof. So obviously, you know, this kind of like the world is against us, the world is against us drumbeat has been getting steadily louder over the last few years.
And it goes into the cultural and sports realm now. And so what kinds of consequences does this cultural cynicism, this apathy have for the future of Russia?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Lately, there's been some positive developments when we look at Russia's youngest generation, when we look at the high schoolers who have known nothing but Putin in their entire lives, who have been born, you know, with Putin already as president, somebody who is turning 18, this year, would have known nothing but Putin. And they, you can explain to them as much as you want that Putin is the only thing standing between, you know, Russia and chaos. But the problem is that since they haven't really encountered the sort of the poverty and the chaos and the criminality of the 90s firsthand, there's only so long that they're going to take your word for it. And it's very hard to explain to modern sort of plugged in, global youth that, every other country has, every other country you want to emulate, has changing rulers, and only ours just has this one guy. So there is a bit of hope there, but the problem is that, of course, the apathy might win out in the end, because as long as there's relative economic stability, there's actually very little invested in changing the status quo.
Michael Idov, thank you as well today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Idov is the author of Dressed Up for a Riot. It's a memoir of his years in Russia. He spoke to us from Berlin. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Anna Maria is back with you tomorrow. Thank you for lending us your ear here on The Current.